Well, hello everyone, good afternoon, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph for another Thursday. It's Thursday, May the 14th, and I'm joining you once again from the Upside Down. This week it is the Upside Down, deep in the heart of Guelph, with my secret setup that no one really knows about, but I'm not going to reveal where it is. I'm just telling you, tubes give the richest sound. I think I mentioned that last week. And I'm very pleased, as usual, I think you can hear him there, to be joined by Adam A. Donaldson. Adam A. Donaldson, are you on the line?
I'm on the line.
Fantastico. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. How's things in the north? As I always ask, how's things in the north?
We the north. It's all good here in the north end. A little rainy now, but what can you do?
Yes, deeply ensconced in the bunker, I cannot see the rain, but soon enough I will emerge and breathe deeply because you take what you can get these days, right? Anyway, today on the show we have the reaction response to the COVID-19 situation in America, in Trumpland, and in the White House, and all of those places. And an evolving story, lots has happened today even. I'm sure Adam has been very close to the wire following events. And also, is oil dead? Elizabeth May and the state of oil in Canada and around the world. And we will get into that a bit, to the comments that she had made. But and of course, at the 5:30 point of the show, we will have Mayor Cam Guthrie, as interviewed by our very own Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. In this, well, I guess there's a bit of overlap there, right? But many, many, many hats. I was, where was I? I can't remember where I was, and I heard end credits just coming through the air, and I was like, Adam, it's Adam. I haven't seen Adam in so long. And I was like, oh no, it's actually just a broadcast, so. I think I'm getting a little bit stir-crazy in the bunker here, Adam. I don't know about you.
I haven't seen you in so long. I think I need a haircut, and maybe I should start going down to City Hall and protesting about me needing a haircut.
Yeah, that's a good way to get some press without making it yourself, I guess. Just, I want a haircut. Yeah. I mean, you've seen quite a few people out there, and whether it's in Zoom land or wherever, that really, really do need haircuts. And it's kind of, even Trudeau, too. There's so much hair there. He doesn't know what to do with it. Because I think if he got a cut, they would say, oh, who cut Justin's hair?
But If Justin Trudeau came out with a shave and a haircut, there would be demands for a public inquiry before the press conference was over.
Like, Sophie could pretty much watch the video like everybody else has and try and figure out how to work the clippers or the Flowbee or whatever. But although, if you want a haircut in the United States, it looks like you probably be able to get one in some states anyway. Sounds like 42 of them are going to open up to some degree over the next week. None of them have met the criteria, as I guess it's voluntary criteria put out, that you should have a 14-day decline in COVID-19 cases before you do that. And they're just like, wow, the economy. Wow, the haircuts. We need to get at that. And of course, top of mind in this discussion is one Donald J. Trump.
Oh, him.
Yeah, you remember that guy? The guy who shuts down press conferences. Like, I think you saw the emergency shutdown of the press conference. It wasn't really emergency. It was just kind of like, okay, I'm out of here. Thanks very much. Ask Gina. See you later, right?
I didn't see it live because city council was still going when it happened. But of course, because it was city council, so I was on Twitter. So I kept the number of Trump-related trending topics was increasing, and I was like, oh, what did he do? And of course, that's what he did, is that a reporter from CBS News, who is of Chinese descent, I think actually she was born in China, but she was raised in the United States, asked him about, you know, why is it a competition about which countries have the most cases and doing the most testing, and he said, why don't you ask China, because, you know, she looks Asian, and he never misses an opportunity to slam China or female journalists who are also people of color either.
It sounds like every one of them asked nasty questions. Only you would ask me such a nasty question. But he seems to be able to pick out the I wouldn't say the faults, but he will zero in and it'll be like, well, you work for that paper, now you work for this paper, and there's a reason you did that because is you ask nasty questions. Like, he always amazingly has something like that ready, and of course there are lots of things that he does not have ready. He always has a ready answer for what the response is for COVID-19, but as to whether there's any remote accuracy as to what's going on, it'll be tremendous, whatever it is, but it's, according to Obama, recorded in a somewhat secret conversation. Not really. There's a, I guess they have an alumni call. Old presidents get together and have this chat, it would seem. And I suppose they used to do it in person, but you probably heard the recording of Obama calling what's going on at the White House regarding COVID-19 an absolute chaotic disaster and also anemic and spotty response. I'm not sure what Trump's response to that was. It was something like, we've saved millions of lives. And with a number of 80,000 dead, if it hasn't almost hit that, it's almost impossible to put a number to it because it just keeps going up. And well over, 1.3 million infected in the U.S.? I'm not really sure how that's saving lives or an amazing, tremendous response.
No. And I mean, it gets even worse than that, because you had Dr. Anthony Fauci and some of his fellow high ranking scientific officials in the government. So you had people like Robert Redfield, who's the head of the CDC and the FDA commissioner, Stephen Hick, and these are like three of the main people who, you know, when you're talking about virus or pandemic control, these are three of the people. But they are, of course, now all three of them in some kind of quarantine after it was revealed last week that there was a White House valet with COVID-19. There was the press secretary for the vice president, who is married to one of the most senior advisors to the president.
The mysterious Stephen Miller, right?
I'm not sure how mysterious it is, like who he is.
Well, it's a mystery as to whether he's actually like a crypto Nazi or not, but it sounds like
I don't think that's a mystery either.
No.
But but yeah, because these people have been exposed and because they all get together and have the coronavirus task force meetings and other meetings in the White House, they have to now sequester Anthony Fauci in his, you know, rather attractive looking home office situation. But
I bet he's actually read those books that are behind him. You know, they always say, who's read the books that are behind them? Fauci has probably, did they call him Fauci? I don't know, I just did. The Fauci has read those books. Yeah, and he's seen, what was it? Trump's response was like, well, I don't agree with him on that. He's, I guess, I don't know if that's an attempt at Trump being diplomatic. I think it was directly in regards to opening the schools. The quote was, he wants to play all sides of the equation. And it's like, no, he actually wants people to be safe, because it would seem with the opening of the schools, there is this condition, particularly in New York City, but I'm sure it's in other places too. It would seem that somebody, a young person in London, UK, died of what they were calling mystery inflammatory syndrome, has a longer name, pediatric multi-system inflammatory syndrome. In other words, it resembles Kawasaki disease. They're not sure how it works. It seems to go hand in hand with COVID-19. So, I mean, no wonder Fauci's like, you know, you need to watch, because these are the things that can happen if you just blow it wide open. And it's like, well, I don't really agree with him. It's like, well, okay, who do you believe, right?
Right, and you had Fauci try, and I think it was a bit refreshing for Anthony Fauci to be able to deliver this news to an audience that wasn't the press, but, you know, the people who helped inform policy at the congressional level, but also without Donald Trump leaning over his shoulder or stopping him from answering a question or coming back after he answers a question and saying, well, what Dr. Fauci really meant was the complete opposite of what he said. And then you had Dr. Rick Bright testifying today. Dr. Rick Bright was a high-ranking government official who was seemingly demoted because he refused to go along with the scheme to order states and cities to start handing out hydrochloroquine, which was at one time the magic cure-all. So he became a whistleblower, and he was testifying today. And of course, right there, the thing that people picked out of his opening testimony was that we don't want to have, or we want to take action so that we don't have the darkest winter in modern U.S. history, which is something everybody immediately kind of seized on as, I guess, the key bit of what he was trying to say in his testimony.
Yeah, it's kind of echoes of winter is coming, but this is, you know, darkest winter is a very succinct way to put it. He probably knew that he was going to get a massive soundbite out of that, because that's what's necessary, is to get that message out. It's like, look, it's this. What else? He said something to the effect, and I only caught a piece of it too, that, you know, the truth has to transcend politics.
Yeah.
And if he's seeing these things as a doctor, as a medical person, scientist, he was fired from the Department of Health and Human Services for having this opinion, which of course Trump and company didn't like. Fauci is getting there. I don't know if we're going to see him let go during or shortly after his quarantine. It'll probably depend on how much or how well or how poorly the next 2 weeks goes. And I'm sure it will be, if he does get canned, it will be something along the lines of, well, it's Fauci's fault that everything fell, you know. Well, it's his fault. Another fall guy, right? Because that's how the White House works these days. It's his fault. It's not our fault. It's the WHO. WHO's fault. It's Fauci's fault. It's the whistleblower's fault, right?
It might be tricky, though, because I think Fauci has gotten almost, like, too big to be fired. Because I think there are a lot of Republicans who see him as a highly respected public official. And it's been so weird sort of watching people dig up. I saw one post on Twitter. Somebody says, like, I was looking through some old magazines in the attic, and here's this profile of Dr. Fauci in, like, 1990. So
he it looks like Ringo or something. I did see that picture, right?
It's has such a long-standing history, and he has such a long-standing reputation with, like, so many people in power, so many people in Congress, and who have served in various other administrations on both sides, Republican and Democrat. If Trump were to fire him willy-nilly, like, to pull a Comey, I guess, if we want to put it that way.
Yeah.
It would not look good, especially if they're still adding like 2,000, 3,000 deaths every day or every couple of days, to just like S-can somebody of Fauci's reputation and expertise and experience. It's something that I think even Donald Trump, it would be akin to the whole Ukraine call thing. It would be like a step too far make even Republicans uncomfortable. They would still forgive it, of course, but they wouldn't like it.
That was a perfect phone call, though. It was just like the phone call. So there was a bit of sparring with this committee this week, Fauci versus Rand Paul, a congressperson who has actually had COVID-19, and it would seem the
Republican... And is a doctor.
And is a doctor of some description. He's not, I'm not sure what his area of focus is, but he is a doctor. But none of the Republicans at the meetings, at least the ones that were in person, were wearing masks, although some of them were indeed in isolation because of the cases you mentioned at the White House, taking every precaution. Sure. So Trump is going mask-free. He's not going to wear it. Pence still hasn't shown with a mask, I guess, even though, where were they? And it was like, masks required. He's like, no. It was like a mask factory or something, wasn't it?
He was delivering PPE to like a long-term care home or a nursing home or something like that. It was kind of like a photo op, but he wasn't wearing a mask. And if you look at the photo, everybody's wearing a mask except for Mike Pence and his press secretary. And of course, what happened the next day, it turns out that the press secretary has COVID-19.
Yeah, she probably didn't catch it at the mask factory. Who knows, but...
No,
it's possible. I suppose it's almost impossible. In fact, they might have caught it in somewhere in the White House. By the sounds of it, if the valet had it as well, somehow Trump doesn't. I'm not sure. Like the valet is up close and personal and touching all your stuff. Generally, I don't know what kind of. Maybe it was just the shoe shiner person. Who knows? But that, you know, as is trending in the U.S., it is the shoe shine people that are getting COVID-19 and paying the ultimate price for it. So,
well, I wouldn't say too much about Trump's health out of all this, because I think it's been long since established that he has Three Stooges disease, where they're all trying to get all the bugs are trying to get through the door at once, so they all get stuck, which is what Mr. Burns has.
Right. Yes. He's got the curly, no, the Larry, the Mower, Shemper, whoever. I can't believe I named them all off the top of my head. That's like a trivia question. But yeah, this is the Three Stooges response. That might be a good way to put it. You know, do you go with Fauci or do you go with the Plandemic video, which I'm still people sharing that I thought would probably know better, but I just, you know.
Well, it's
we
not
remain
that,
friends, it's a, but I do not follow them anymore. You know, it's like it's that.
It's a complete assault on expertise, because this is one of the sort of things that have gone under the wire, is that there's this group called Eco Health Alliance, which was a nonprofit, and it had spent years, 15 years, cataloging bat-borne illnesses, and then they lost their funding, and they lost about $3.4 million in grant money. And the reason why is the people they were working alongside of in China were none other than the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is, of course, where Donald Trump and others are of the opinion that China created the COVID-19 bug to, you know, shoot the world economy in the head, in that conspiracy theory. So you have an example here of, like, this group losing funding, losing their work, could have come in handy right now, basically because of a president who's susceptible to conspiracy beliefs.
So I'm glad you summed that up. I didn't even really want to watch the lowlights of it, right? It was just like, no, I'm just not going to do it. I kept seeing it, and it's just not on. And something that's not on in Elizabeth May's world is oil, particularly Canadian oil or tar sands oil or whatever, whatever we're calling it now, Western. What is our official oil title? Western. Oh, my God. It's right on the tip of my tongue. Every once in a while, we get caught out with these things. Western. You oil? Got me there? No, I guess not. Western oil. I feel like I'm in some kind of sketch. Anyway, the oil out of the tar sands. Elizabeth May said oil is dead. Now, you'd think she'd said God was dead, but we know oil is God in certain parts of this country. Anyway, the corporate money parts. She said, here's a direct quote from what she was saying. My heart bleeds for people who believe that the sector is going to come back. It's not. Oil is dead. And for people in the sector, it's very important there be just transition funds. And that was like throwing a grenade under the table in certain circles.
I think one of the things that sort of struck me that's been missing from the national conversation, like Elizabeth May is no stranger to making controversial comments, of course, but I mean, so far as controversial comments go, this may be fairly innocuous, but one of the things I think is missing from the national conversation, especially when you're talking about mainstream media, because the person who asked the question was from the CBC. It was Julie something from the CBC. I can't remember. Julie Van Dusen from the CBC.
Seasoned reporter, Julie Van Dusen.
Yeah. And she was asking about should there be bailout money for the oil company, which got that response from Elizabeth May. And then Julie Van Dusen says, are you saying that oil is dead? Which, you know, kind of teed up Elizabeth May. And Elizabeth May took the bait so that there's this highly quotable thing going around where Elizabeth May has said oil is dead. But there's a thing, because you also go to CTV and Power and Politics. You have reporters there kind of losing their minds about it. Same thing on Global. There's an opinion piece on the Global website written by one of the commentators there about how Elizabeth May has lost her mind because oil is such an essential part of the economy. We're just whether or not you have people on staff who think oil is dead, I don't care. What I really think we're missing from the conversation is just oil skepticism. Someone who can ask the question, like, is oil coming back? And not only that, but someone who needs to put the numbers in place too, because Molly Thomas on CTV was like, well, this is 11% of our economy, and it's not. And if you go to the Canada's own website, the Government of Canada's own website, it notes that 10.6% of Canada's GDP is energy. Energy includes oil, coal, nuclear, natural gas, and renewable energy. And when you drill down into those numbers, it's about 5.6% of GDP that's represented by oil and gas. So we have a situation where Oil is sacrosanct. Nobody wants to touch it, not even the press. And when they do touch it, they, I don't want to say propaganda, but I will, they help with the propaganda, this opinion that this is such an essential sector of the economy. When the fact of the matter is, I mean, how long now has oil been sort of in the doldrums in Canada? It's been like since 2014, right?
Yes. 5 years for sure. And in doing the research for this, was an interesting article that I remembered seeing on Vice from 2017. And I went searching for it. And it was saying that they'd spoken to two economists back then. And their prediction was prices are going to crash. Mm-hmm. And high cost extraction oil will, quote, shrivel. Mm. So Western Canadian Select, right? Mm. Our Western Canadian Select is difficult to get out of the ground. It's what various names for it, dirty oil going currently. And that was, I think that was something that John Iveson in the National Post got right, was that's $22 a barrel right now. He also used that figure of 10% GDP. You said 11. It is the one that pro oil commentators, let's say, throw around saying you can't do that. It's 10% of the GDP. And the amount of tax that comes, revenue that comes from it, is always inflated. It's like, let's just say Trump style, where he just makes up a number and it's random and large just to sound good, not realizing that somebody will probably do the homework after the fact. And it looks like Elizabeth May did that. She was allowed to, credit to the Post. They gave her space to do a rebuttal to sort of counter what John Iveson has said. So it was like the back and forth about what she got to clarify what she was saying. The Calgary Sun, who is, I would say they were probably friendly as well, is saying that Elizabeth May misunderstands basic economics. No, I think what she's saying, that she wants a different economics, right? But she can pretty much say whatever, I think, at this point, because we know, it's been a bit sidelined because of COVID, among other things, that there's a race on to replace her as well. And I'm surprised that didn't come up. When they talk about Andrew Scheer, it always comes up like, well, he's not going to be the leader for a while. But in Elizabeth May's case, it never does come up. But I guess it's far enough away in the distance. Is it September, October?
Yeah, October.
But another example, just quickly, Premier Brad Wall, former Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall, called Elizabeth May's statement disrespectful. And that's probably because he's on the boards of directors of Whitecap Resources and Maxim Corporation. So he's not exactly an unbiased take. All you see is former Premier Brad Wall says this is, this is disrespectful and it's an insult to anybody that works in the industry.
Right.
But he works in the industry, right? So, they all do it, right? Jason Kenney, when he finally gets deposed, will end up working for whomever, right?
Right.
And that's where Harper got his start, Imperial Oil. So there's, there's two channels there, but they sort of run parallel to each other in terms of oil commentary and politicians and the papers that they own, right?
Right. And the response, I think, is super inflated, too. And we never address what's happening on this sort of the sidelines of things. You have the CFO of Royal Dutch Shell, who's telling shareholders on the one hand that demand will never come back. And you have people in Canada here that, again, because as you said, our oil is incredibly hard to get out of the ground. You have them thinking not only is oil going to come back, but it's going to come back so hard that our oil is going to become super lucrative again. When the fact of the matter is that the easy oil to get is cheap as blank right now. And then you just have all these things sort of nipping at the sides. The Norwegian Central Bank Wealth Fund, which is one of the most wealthiest of the wealth funds, has blacklisted four Canadian companies. What are they? Canadian Natural Resources, Suncor, Cenovus, and Imperial Oil. Why do you think that is?
Dirty oil, perhaps?
Yeah.
And Norway is one of the countries that did it right, because if I understand it right, they are devolving from fossil fuels, but also the way that they structured their program has made everybody in Norway as a country very, very wealthy per capita. Mm-hmm. And supposedly they based that program on the original, not price recovery, but taxation structure of oil from Alberta in the 70s. I think it was under Lougheed, but that's, again, a completely different story, but there's a way to get revenue for governments to get revenue from oil Candler has generally done very poorly in that department. And at this point, it doesn't matter. It's like you said, because the price is literally in the toilet. The break-even price, if it's processed in place for Western Canadian Select, is in the range of $55 to $60. So that's what they have to sell it at to make anything resembling a not even a profit, break even.
And the thing is, the share is so small because Canada, we're talking 5.6%. And to bring this a bit closer to home, when the University of Guelph divested a couple of weeks ago, last month, I should say, you had the chancellor, Martha Biles, resign in protest. She, if you listen to the meeting, or if, I don't know if there's a recording of it anywhere, but I listened to the meeting, she was incredibly incensed that the university would consider such a move, and she thought it disrespectful to the oil industry. And it's like, well, look at the numbers. The VP of finance at the university said that 7% of the endowment was invested in fossil fuels. It's peanuts. It's $28 million. And most of that is invested in non-Canadian fossil fuel companies like BP. It's become such a sticking point to a select group of people that oil is Canadian identity. And what happens when A, the oil goes away, or B, society in general goes away from oil? And is that what's happening right now? Because the part of this that we haven't talked about yet is the climate change angle.
Mm-hmm.
And people wanting to move away from fossil fuels in order to secure a non-climate ravaged earth in the near future. And that's kind of what people are thinking about now. It just seems like there are aspects to this thing that never get explored, because it's oil is Canadian identity. And if you do not fall into that column, then you are a traitor, or you don't quote unquote get it. And it's just that, and then that point of view is like seriously lacking in a lot of the mainstream media coverage, at least the mainstream media coverage I watch, including CBC, liberal bastion CBC.
Well, yeah, but the oil producers, under the guise of associations like the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, mm-hmm. and the companies themselves have some very heavy artillery when it comes to lobbying, which yep. is intertwined directly with government, as I've mentioned earlier, but also they just fire resources at it and get media out there that's very, considering the state of media these days, is very quickly pick a story up that's already prefab ready to go that says, oil, in fact, isn't dead. Oil is the greatest thing. It's such a big part of our GDP, and it employs so many people and employ more people. And the spin is generally the same. Slightly different, but generally the same. But
for sure.
Speaking of the same, it's time once again to go to a bit of a break. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. And we are going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with some more exciting stuff. So stay tuned. Yes, the wonderful sounds of, I believe, Kitchener-based, or at least Tri-Cities area, Onion Honey, from their album Earthly Trails and Safe Home. I hope you are all safe home, whatever home is to you right now. They are actually one of the bands that was supposed to have played Guelph before COVID-19 kind of shut the world down. So shout out to them. That's a lovely song. I believe that was written by one of the band members themselves. Pretty sure Esther Whedon. There you go. So Esther from the band wrote that original tune just for you. So as promised, we have an interview with Mayor Cam Guthrie that I didn't forget his name, honestly, Adam A. Donaldson did earlier. I believe it was yesterday. and it was good of Cam to give some time to the show. He's going to give a bit of an update on what's been going on in town, because there obviously has been so much going on. So rather than me sort of yammer on about what the heck might or might not be going on, here is Adam and Cam Guthrie, Mayor Cam Guthrie.
So I first wanted to ask about just, you know, sort of the general spot where we are. I think the last time we kind of had, you and I anyway, had a one-on-one chat was just right after the state of emergency was declared. And we've kind of been in a long plateau since then of just sort of like managing the day-to-day crisis. And at the beginning of the meeting on Monday, you basically said to, you know, the people of Guelph, you know, it's still going on. Take a breather. I know everybody's frustrated. So in terms of like that management, that sort of people management, you know, what is the day-to-day struggle for you right now?
Well, I think, yeah, I think you've actually placed that positioned that question very well when you say that the day-to-day kind of people management. I would say that that's just a very good way of setting it up. I think that there's already come a point, I think it was probably a couple of weeks ago, where the level of impatience and frustration and unknowns is starting to wane on people. And that includes me. I think that's important to state. But at the same time, we need to remember why we're doing this. And that's why I broached that subject right off the top. That was, you know, you know me, this community, I think, knows me pretty well. I shoot from the hip.
Yeah.
I hardly ever have any prepared remarks. I could count in the last 5 years, maybe on one hand, I've ever had really prepared remarks. And that was prepared remarks that I had in the opening of my council meeting on Monday, because I really wanted to be clear with people why we're still doing this. We are in a pandemic. There is an emergency, and we need to take it seriously, even though I acknowledge that we have been inconvenienced, that it is frustrating. And we just need to remember to pull together as a community. And I don't mean to have it ever come across as top down, as I'm better than somebody else or judging somebody else. We are all in this together. And I hope that that's the type of message that I'm portraying as we go through the people management, as you called it, stages of this emergency.
Mm-hmm. Are you?
We have to stay the course,
right?
Because the course that we've been on has been successful to date. Mm-hmm. So, as the economy opens back up, as the provincial or federal government starts lifting restrictions, we have to make sure that we manage within those restrictive limits and not push past them just because we're frustrated or just because we're inconvenienced. And we need to be able to, as I said, extend grace and some patience and some tolerance and have acceptance around the decisions that are being made right now, because we're dealing with something that no one has ever dealt with before.
Right. And I imagine that's part of the frustration too. And I think that comes from both sides, is from the government end, you're dealing with having to take unprecedented action. And from the public end, we're having to take unprecedented action and sort of pay more attention to those public service announcements than ever. I guess, and I know you've been sort of exploring things through the Economic Task Force, but, you know, I wonder if we need like an activity in the community, you know, something that can, you know, focus the minds, give people something to do to at least on a government level to like help them feel engaged and like part of the process and not just, you know, like that top down you were saying.
Yeah. And you know what? I think, I mean, you just came up with an idea there within your question to me that, you know, maybe it is something that we need to create something to rally around this issue in a positive way. Maybe there is something that we could do. And I'm open to those ideas completely. It's just that I would probably say, though, that there are a lot of activities, and I'm doing air quotes right now, that people could definitely hang their hat on, you know, activities like supporting, you know, agencies in town, trying to figure out ways of supporting our frontline workers, donating to the most vulnerable in our community, the agencies that are looking after them, you know, right from kid activities that are, you know, painting rocks like that I saw for our nurses and doctors at the hospital, mm-hmm. To give them support, to buying lawn signs, to tying red ribbons around trees for the Rotary. There are activities. There, I guess, a more common activity, one thing, is something definitely to contemplate as we move forward, for sure. I think that's a good idea. Maybe something we can think of.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I helped. In terms of, you know, City Hall, I know that the building itself is sort of minimally staffed right now, but I mean, sort of the general feeling amongst city staff, because some have been furloughed, some are kind of had to sort of radically change their workloads. I can't imagine they're having a great deal of fun in the financial department these days. What can you tell me about sort of the attitude at City Hall and how staff are sort of tackling the crisis?
Well, I'm at City Hall right now. I'm in my office as I'm doing this interview with you right now. And I think there's maybe four or five people in the building altogether when there would be hundreds normally. So I would say, wow, that's a great question. So this is purely just observation from my end. Mm-hmm. I would say that there's a lot of emotions going on right now. I think that there's probably equally frustration with people. Need to remember that municipalities are at the, you know, we are the third level of government down. So as the federal government makes an announcement, it trickles down to us. Or as the provincial government makes an announcement, it trickles down to us. And then we have to try to respond to those issues as they come from the upper levels of government. On top of that, we have to respond to our own local health unit. And, you know, there can be inconsistent directions or advice dependent upon the area, which makes sense, of the health unit. So you could have one health unit that's way up north of the province that's making a decision because based on the elements that they're dealing with up there, it's completely different than the ones that we're dealing with here in our health unit. Mm. And so there can be some sort of fracture within some of the messaging, but it's because it's reliant upon the territory that's being represented by those health units. So that's something we have to tackle with here. And then I would also say that from an executive and management point of view, they are handling it extremely well, but they are run off their feet. It is, you know, any type of inclination that they aren't working or aren't doing jobs is just hogwash. I see them run off their feet, and as they are run off their feet, they are very sad, I guess it's maybe that their colleagues, which many of them refer to them as a family, of employees that are here that would be doing work in whatever department or service that they provide, they aren't here right now, and they are thinking about those people that aren't working right now. Mm-hmm. And just like in the private sector, all the businesses that I've been talking to, management or the bosses or the presidents of companies, CEOs, they instantly say, you know, the first thing on their mind is their employees. Mm-hmm. And I would say that from a management perspective here, what I've observed is their deep sort of sense of responsibility and care for the employees that are either still working and especially for those that aren't.
Right. That's a pretty good segue into talking a bit more about the economic task force then. I know that there have been some directions and that was discussed at the meeting on Monday. I think, though, what I've been hearing, and a lot of this has come from MPP Schreiner, too, is that the big issue, or maybe one of the big issues right now, is rent and getting some rent relief. And I'm wondering, for a lot of the small businesses in town, is sort of the discussion about how to restart the economy sort of moot until they know that they're going to have a business to operate out of. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So, how much... I guess, can the economic task force really be as effective until the answer of rent is answered?
So I would say yes. And in fact, your question is well placed, because I just had a conversation for a half an hour with MPP Schreiner on this exact issue at 8:30 this morning. So well done. Yes, we can be effective, because the role of the task force, and especially from a municipal perspective, is really one at this point more around advocacy work, pressure to the province, pressure to the federal government, and taking the stories, the on the ground stories, and humanizing the impacts of what this is, COVID-19 is happening to the businesses, and then relaying that through the task force, through endorsement and advocacy up to the upper levels of government that actually have the authority and the wherewithal to be able to actually make changes. The specific one right now, although there's others that are coming through the task force, specific to your question about rent, is one of advocacy in regards to especially commercial rent, where you have landlords that are choosing to not participate in the rent relief programs that have been set up from the federal and the provincial government. Mm-hmm. And you have tenants now that are left hanging, and that is completely wrong. And that is something that we're advocating for.
Okay. I guess the other question about the economic task force is, you said it's kind of about advocacy at the moment. And, I imagine a lot of that is going to have to, involve sort of how we open, because for a lot of small businesses, space is the issue. There's a lot of small spaces downtown where social distancing is always going to be an issue. And I guess, what is your task force advocating in terms of how businesses reopen and how they're trying to shape the guidelines and the requirements that will both allow people to be safe, but will also allow them to start making some kind of living again?
Yeah, certainly. That has come up quite a bit through the task force, and rightly so. So, again, one of the things that I've advocated for through that feedback through the task force right up to the ministers is two things on that. The first one is about communication in advance of when different restrictions are going to be lifted or whatever the next phase is. And as an example, the last restriction and announcement, I think two Fridays ago occurred. And again, it was on a Friday afternoon or even over a weekend. And the city can't respond to those types of issues when we're finding them out on a Friday.
Right.
Just as businesses can't respond that way, businesses and the municipality need more lead time to be able to figure out what they need to do to open properly. So that's the first one. The second one is consistency in the regulations around opening. So we don't want any kind of fracture in amongst our own city or pitting one city against another city when it comes to the reopening of businesses. There needs to be a consistent message around social distancing, PPE, any of those types of things that's coming from the province, so that, a hairdresser that wants to open up, at one part of the city has the exact same way of opening up as another one in a different part of the city. And then, as I said, city to city, not just within the own city. I guess one more thing I did say too, one more thing is around the PPE issue, just quickly, is we're looking through the task force to try to help with buying power, because we want to see if there's a role to play either through the municipality or through other agencies where we can have a one-stop sort of shop or a one-stop ordering place for as PPE is required for these businesses when they open up, that they are prepared, that they have what's needed. You don't want to catch these people to find out, oh, you're going to be opening on Monday, and you find out on a Friday, but they don't have the equipment that they need to do that. And that's, again, back to the lead time for these businesses.
I just want to rewind for a second in terms of the provincial announcements on things. They are it sounds like you're sort of saying that you're finding out about announcements and things at, I guess, at roughly the same time the rest of us do, with like the release of media statements and the Premier's daily announcement. You're not getting any kind of lead time, like from the ministry and them saying like, hey, just a heads up, here's what we're going to be announcing today?
Well, that has now come up in conversation with ministers since the last time they did that, because they want to make sure. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
When two Fridays ago, I believe it was, all the days are kind of running together now, but I think it was a couple Fridays ago, it was announced that on the Monday, they were going to be opening up new, what is now going to be deemed as essential construction work.
Right.
Well, then that requires municipal building inspectors. But some of our municipal building inspectors, they may not be at work right now. They might have, so for us to turn around from a Friday to a Monday over a weekend to try to figure out how to bring those people back to work and get them caught up to speed about what's been happening and then have them hit the ground on the Monday, it's just it causes a little bit of a chaos. We need more advance notice on these things. And so the government has heard us on that. Okay. And they understand that role. And so we're hoping that from here on out that we will be given a little bit of a heads up on announcements that are coming. Now, as my role as the chair of LUMCO, I have been working almost daily, that's not an exaggeration, with the province, especially around the fiscal relief issues that municipalities are facing, and how we could form programs to help municipalities across the province. And so for that type of communication, I've definitely been in the loop on sort of what is being thought of, but definitely nothing to me yet about any final results or when an announcement will be made on that. But I have definitely been working alongside them on that.
So you're fairly positive there's going to be some kind of stimulus to municipalities via the, at least the provincial government.
Well, right now my answer would be that I am positive that the talks are happening.
Okay.
I am positive that the talks are happening and that they are happening between the province and the federal government. But that's as far as the information that I have right now. As I said, my role has been to work alongside them, to offer them advice, to give them suggestions, to really give a lay of the land as to what the impacts are to the municipalities. As an example, for transit, we've been working with transit institutions from a LUMCO perspective to get real data, real numbers, real metrics that we can share with the province. All of that is feeding into the conversations that I do know that they are having.
I imagine transit is, I noticed in the LUMCO press releases and the materials from, you know, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities too, that transit is sort of like a big piece of this, because hardly anybody's using transit, but it still has to be there in order to ferry essential workers to the places they need to be. And not to mention that, but, you know, the people who have to do, you know, run errands, go to the grocery store, the pharmacy or whatever.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, it is. Of the work through LUMCO, I am stating to the ministers that the overall impacts of just transit probably accounts for between 30 to 40% of the overall fiscal problems that municipalities are having. So it is a large amount that municipalities are shouldering right now in regards to the transit issue. And the conversation that I've been having is not so much focused on only, hey, help us out because of the fiscal situation now. Of course, that's part of it. But it's also in discussions about what do we do tomorrow and what do we do next week and what do we do a month from now and what do we do 6 months from now and how is this really going to play out for our communities when it comes to transit versus physical distancing. That is going to be, I believe, a major problem moving forward for across North America, transportation issues. I'll give you an example. It's been comforting to me, and I don't mean that obviously in a, in a really good way, but it's comforting to me that the hit to the province's transit systems through Metrolinx is mirroring exactly what municipalities are facing. So one of the stats that I've been told is that normally about 333,000 people a day use Metrolinx. That's down to about 30,000.
Yeah.
And so our ability as a LUMCO, my ability as the chair to advocate on these issues is not foreign to the provincial government right now. They're experiencing it themselves. They know what they're going through. And that translates to what we're going through.
Maybe to wrap up, I'm wondering in a general sense, you know, what dealing with the pandemic has maybe taught you about the job of being mayor. Again, going full circle, talking about the unprecedentedness of this, of these times, you know, how has the pandemic changed your job and the way you do your job?
Well, I thought I was tired before. boy, a lot of emotions for me too. I tried to give sort of my observations of what the management and the executive team are going with that previous question, but I would say, you know, similar. You know, I'm going on a roller coaster ride as well of emotions. There is sadness because I'm hearing of people that have lost their lives to COVID. That's affecting the community. I have my own family where I'm experiencing the emotional roller coasters of, you know, job issues or with my own kids in school and their jobs and what they're looking forward to. And then being the mayor is really, you know, if there's any a time where it was always said, oh, the role of a mayor is to be a spokesperson, my goodness, this is that time. you're communicating as best as you possibly can, armed with the best information that you have at the time. And the issue with that during COVID-19 is that the information you have at the time could literally change 24 hours later.
Right.
And so that's why it's constant communication. The supports that I've received from the executive team have been phenomenal in the Emergency Operations Center. The supports from fellow mayors have been fantastic because we're all going through these similar issues. And then council has been really great as well. And overall, the community has listened and responded to the requests that I have made on behalf of either the Emergency Operations Center or on behalf of the public health units in town. And that messaging has worked because the flattening of the curve certainly has happened, and Guelph has fared very, very well compared to some other cities. And I think that's because we pulled together really well. So there's always a few people that, you know, even before COVID-19, we're always kind of nipping at your heels about whatever issue is there, and those people are still there. Overall, it has been a great challenge. And I like challenges, and I like trying to figure out solutions. That's my personality and my character, and I like that. So this has just been a really interesting time to be able to lead.
And that was Mayor Cam Guthrie with Guelph Politico and Open Source's Chief Assignment Editor, Adam A. Donaldson. Thank you for joining us this week. We are almost completely out of time. Again, you've been listening to, once again, Open Source's here on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. Please join us at this time, hopefully every week at 5 o'clock for more of this show. And Adam, if people were looking for more info on you, where can they reach you?
I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook and Scotty Hertz on Twitter. And I don't know what the heck else I'm doing, but I have to go. It seems there's a clanking sound from the top of the bunker. I think somebody's trying to undo the wheel that's holding the lid on it. So,
oh, no.
Anyway, thanks so much for joining us, folks. And we will be back next week. Same bat time and channel. And take care, Adam. I'll talk to you during the week there. But
will do.
Good to hear from you again. We'll be right back.